here are the alternative world possibilities. God could have created this kind of world or that kind of world, and we pointed out that God could not have created certain worlds, at least certain worlds would not have been better. The whole crux of this argument rests on this premise. You can't say something is morally better unless it's moral. But no world is not a moral world. No free world is not a moral world. So those two options cannot be said to be morally better. They could be said, the second one, could be said to be metaphysically better. That is, a world where people never sinned, as opposed to a world where people did. That could be metaphysically better. But would such a world achieve the greatest good? My answer is no. The only way you can achieve the greatest good is to produce the best of all possible worlds. And the best of all possible worlds is a world where sin is defeated, the higher virtues are attained, and where the full exercise of freedom was permitted. That is the kind of world we have. Therefore, God has done his best. Now, in light of that argument, many atheists back off and say, well, I'll take just a good world opposed to that better world then. I'll take a world where people were free, no one ever sinned, as opposed to a world where they were free, some did sin, and then salvation and the higher virtues are attained. Because at least in the world where they're free and they didn't sin, you don't have any sin. And if that world is only good, but not best, it's good because it's untried good. It's not best because it's untried. It's good because there's no evil, but it's not best because it didn't attain the greater goods like patience and courage and fortitude, which you can't get unless there's evil present. They just settle for a good world. Of course, if you take that alternative, that I'll take a good world where sin didn't occur as opposed to a better world where sin did occur, then you no longer have an objection against God. Because the objection only works if you say this: God must do his best. He didn't do his best, therefore he's evil. See, the argument only works if it is an evil to do less than your best. Five people drowning, you rescue one. It's an evil because you could have done better. But if God doesn't have to do his best, then it's all right for him to do good. And this is a good world. So either the atheist says God has to do his best, in which case our kind of world is the best, or he drops off of that and says God doesn't have to do his best, in which case he loses the basis for his argument in saying God did evil because he didn't do his best. So he has to do it one way or the other. Either God had to do his best, or he could just do any old good thing he wanted to. If he had to do his best, then this is the best kind of world because it attains the higher virtues. If he didn't have to do his best, then they have no complaint against God for not doing his best. That's the only different thing, the only different point that we didn't make in the previous part where we covered the section on could God have created a better world. A confusion between metaphysically better and morally better. Suppose a world where there are no free creatures. Let's just call them animals. Let's suppose a world where there are animals that have no cancer, because animals do get cancer, and a world where there are animals that do have cancer. Now, one is better than the other. But it's not morally better because animals aren't moral beings. It is not morally better to make a world where some have cancer, animals have cancer, and some don't. It's simply metaphysically better, or we might say physically better. They're physically better beings without cancer than they are with cancer. So to say that God could have made a metaphysically better or a physically better world, sure he could have. He could have made a physically better world of hominoids. As long as they weren't God conscious and free, they could have all been perfect, could have lived to be 1,000, no cancer in them. God could have made that kind of world. On the other hand, it wouldn't have been moral, because they're not moral beings. And for anyone to say that kind of world would have been morally better than this kind, where people get cancer, is a category mistake, because they're saying a non-moral world is better than a moral world. It's not even a moral world, it's just metaphysically better. Of course it's metaphysically better. It's not morally better because it's not moral. You can only have a morally better world when you have moral creatures in it. If these creatures aren't moral, they're just physical, just animals, then it cannot be said to be morally better. That's one point that the atheist, I think, often overlooks in his argument, because he's trying to think of a world that would be much better physically than this one. Granted. But once you add the new dimension, these physical beings are free, then somebody's going to clunk somebody else over the head, somebody's going to shoot somebody else, somebody's going to stab somebody else, somebody's going to engage in perverse activity. Pretty soon they're going to get AIDS and herpes, and then you have all of these this evil coming from the abuse of freedom. As long as you make free creatures, you got to expect that evil is going to occur. So then you have to have, a contingency plan. The contingency plan is how to take care of all this evil and ultimately do away with it and make a better world out of it than you could have without it. Could not have made a world where men are free but must sin. This alternative we didn't consider before in the brief form. God could not have made a world where men are free but must sin. This is really the deterministic view, or a hyper-Calvinistic view, that says people were free but they couldn't avoid sinning. For freedom is the ability to avoid sin by oneself and or by God's help. For what man ought to do implies that he can do it. For an all-wise, all-good being never demands what is impossible. But the moral demands versus what cannot be avoided is to demand the impossible. Hence, a moral imperative ought implies moral freedom. It can be done. Now, we're arguing here right in the face of hyper-Calvinism that ought implies can. And the objection to that is, if ought implies can, then the fact that you ought to be saved implies that you can save yourself. But that's not what it said. Ought implies can does not say ought implies you can by yourself. Ought implies either you can by yourself or by someone else's help. And in the case of salvation, ought does imply can. You ought to be saved and you can be saved. Just accept the grace of God and you'll be saved. Doesn't mean work salvation. Ought implies can is not work salvation. Ought implies can is just part of the rationality of the universe. It's utterly absurd to say to somebody, you ought to do it and I blame you for not doing it and I know you couldn't do it. No way. Now, if that makes sense to you, then God is irrational, because God is calling upon people to do what is impossible. Or put it the other way, what is 1 Corinthians 10:13 say? There is always a way of escape. God will never put you in a situation that is not possible for you to resist the sin. Does that mean in your own power? No. It means by his grace. But there will always be a way of escape. You say, but the unsaved people aren't in that situation. Yes, they are. They could get saved. It's always possible for them to believe and get saved. So at any point, it's always possible for everyone not to be sinning. If it weren't, then the law, thou shalt not sin, would be an irrational law, because you would be held culpable for not doing what you couldn't do anyway. It's like blaming somebody for killing another person when you didn't do it. Somebody put the gun in your hand and forced your finger on the trigger and shot them against your will, but you still go to jail for it. No rational human being would blame someone for killing another if he couldn't avoid being forced to do it. And God is at least as rational and moral as human beings, to put it lightly. Therefore, ought does imply can. And to say ought doesn't imply can is an insult to the morality and rationality of both man and God. 23:12. Furthermore, moral praise and blame are meaningless apart from free choice. Both God, by a conscience, and all rational men give moral praise and blame. But both God and all men cannot be engaging in wholly meaningless activity. God cannot because he's absolutely wise and good, and men cannot because it would be contrary to moral norms implied in theism, which would be self-defeating. Finally, not every act in the world can be determined, for determinism must claim that both determinists and non-determinists are determined to believe their contradictory views. But determinists believe determinism is superior and ought to be believed. But on the grounds of determinism, ought has no meaning. It cannot mean could have and should have done otherwise. This is what the non-determinist holds. Nor can he say he is determined to say ought, for then non-determinists too are determined to say ought to believe them. But both cannot be true. Hence, determinism is self-falsifying. That is, determinism necessarily postulates its contradictory non-determinism. But statements which do not exclude their contradictory are meaningless. Hence, determinism is a meaningless and self-falsifying position. Need a letter there. It is one incapable of eliminating its contradictory and stating its own view. But if determinism is not true, then non-determinism is true. That is, if it is not true that all acts cannot be free, then it follows that some acts can be free. But if all men must do evil, then evil is unavoidable. And what is unavoidable is contrary to freedom, which entails the ability to avoid evil. So a world where men are free but cannot avoid sin is impossible. It's rationally and morally impossible. Let me stop to say that is also an answer to B.F. Skinner. And that answer says that B.F. Skinner, everything can't be determined, because if you are determined to believe in freedom and he is determined, behaviorally determined to believe in determinism, and he believes that's superior and he believes you ought to change your mind and accept his view, then when he says that, he's implying that you are free to change your mind and you weren't determined to begin with. But he can't say that, therefore he can't claim his view is true. Once he claims his view is true, it must be false. Because if he claims it's true, it implies freedom. And that's contrary to what he's claiming, that there is no freedom. So determinism is self-defeating or self-falsifying. Top of the next page. What do we mean by depravity then? St. Augustine put it the best of all. He said, you are born with the necessity to die and the propensity to sin. Notice he did not say, you are born with the necessity to sin and the necessity to die. That's what the hyper-Calvinists are saying, that you are born with the necessity to sin. You must sin. I think what we should be saying is this. Sin is inevitable, but not unavoidable. Top of the page. Evil can be inevitable in that God knows it will result from free choices, but evil cannot be unavoidable in the sense that it must happen against free choice. Finally, a theistic worldview where men are free and do sin is better than one where they are free but never sin. And here we simply unfold the argument that it's better because it defeats sin. It's better because it allows full exercise of freedom. It's better because it achieves the greater good. Therefore, if God is the best of all possible beings, he must ultimately produce the best of all possible worlds. The best of all possible worlds cannot be produced without permitting sin. Therefore, God, as the best of all possible beings, if he is going to create a moral world, must permit sin. This is the kind of world that we have, a world where God permits sin in order to destroy it. But a theistic God can produce a world which defeats evil without destroying freedom. For there is no contradiction in a world where creatures are free but sin is defeated. And that's the kind of world that God is working on, where we are now free but sin will be defeated. Since good men could be aided by God never to will to sin by their free choice, we could say, Lord, the spirit is willing, the flesh is weak, help me. And when we freely make that choice and he helps us never to sin again, we could never consider it a violation of our freedom. We could say, Lord, I want to do your will forever. And if he solidifies that and we do his will forever, then we can't complain I lost my freedom any more than I can complain that I am not free to go out with other women because I said, and forsaking all others, to thee only will I cling. And the fact that I have not and am not free to go out with any other women does not mean that I am not fulfilling my freedom, because my freedom is being perfectly fulfilled in the bonds of marriage. So our freedom be perfectly fulfilled in the bonds of heaven. Whatever you bind on earth will be bound in heaven. In fact, will have been bound in heaven. And also will be bound in hell, for that matter, because hell will just permanentize the free choice that people want with regard to it. So we do have that kind of world, and God is accomplishing it. No contradiction in a world where creatures are free, but sin is defeated. Since good men could be aided by God, never to will to sin, and evil men could be separated from God according to their choice, thy will be done. Thus their destiny would be freely chosen. And yet they would no longer be able to spread evil, since God has finalized their free choice. Also, the separation could be eternal, based on the fact that an all-knowing God would not pronounce them hopeless unless he knew they would never change. Now, if somebody raises the question, well, what if someone in hell changed their mind? By the way, be sure and read Problem of Pain by C.S. Lewis, especially the chapter on hell. Somebody raised the question, but what if when they got to hell, they changed their mind? What would God do about it? The answer is, God knows before they get there that they'll never change their mind. He would never have allowed them to go to a permanent place if he knew that their choice wasn't permanent. So omniscience already takes care of that possibility. An omniscient, omnibenevolent mind knows that a lifetime is long enough to make a lifetime decision. You don't need more than a lifetime. And by the way, everyone who ever lived had a lifetime, no matter how long it was. Everyone had a lifetime to make a lifetime decision. So they made a decision, and God pronounced their decision final. He said, have it your way. So the door of hell could be locked eternally, but from the inside. And God knows this beforehand because he's all-knowing. Jesus did not mean that Sodom actually would have repented with a better chance. This raises the question about why Sodom and Gomorrah, why Jesus said, if these miracles had been done in Sodom and Gomorrah, they would have repented in sackcloth and ashes. That sounds like it's contrary to what we just said. Now I'm arguing here, Jesus did not mean that Sodom and Gomorrah actually would have repented with a better chance, that is, more miracles. Rather, he used this as a hypothetical hyperbole to indicate the gravity of their sin. Compare verse 23, which says, it will be more tolerable in the day of judgment. It's a comparative, meaning, look how bad their sin is. I'll never forget how shocked I was when a very dignified, calm Presbyterian teacher of mine a number of years ago, who happened to be the first graduate of Dallas Seminary, Dr. Roy Aldridge, an A in the first class, he was talking about something that was impossible in class, and it was totally out of decorum for him because he was very reserved and very conservative, and he said, that has about as much chance as a cellophane ball in hell. You know, well, not too much chance for a cellophane ball in hell. Well, that's a hyperbole. There won't be any, and indeed a hypothetical one, there won't be any cellophane balls in hell. But Jesus said, my goodness, Sodom and Gomorrah would have repented. Not really. But he's saying, look how wicked you are. By comparison, Sodom and Gomorrah would be repenting. But if Sodom and Gomorrah would have repented with a few more miracles, a little more chance, they would have gotten it. We know so. How? Well, Abraham bargained with God about the whole thing. God was patient and long-suffering. He said, how about if there are 20? How about 15, Lord? How about 10? You know, he bargained. God would have done anything. He couldn't even get three good ones out of there. Four didn't make it. You remember his wife, Morton Salt Company, picked her up after that. 2:4, 4:1-6:3, Jesus said elsewhere that those who will not believe would not be convinced even if the miracle of the resurrection of the dead were performed. Luke 16:31. Neither will they believe though one were raised from the dead. Now it would be contrary to say that God produced evil that brought about the greater good, but God does not produce evil. He simply permits it in order to produce the greater good. And God permits evil by willing the power of free choice to his creatures. But the power of free choice is not an evil, but a good. It's only the evil exercise of free choice that's evil. The fact of freedom is good. It's the acts of freedom that are wrong. For free choice means moral self-determination of one's actions. A self-determined action is not impossible. That's the cause of becoming. A self-determined existence is impossible, the cause of being. That's Jonathan Edwards' mistake. He assumes that an action cannot be self-caused because it would be like a self-caused being. And we've already argued that you can't cause your own being, but you can cause your own becoming. I just caused my becoming over here. God caused my being while I was doing it. I caused my becoming over here. Horizontal cause of being is possible because you have something to push off of. So I had the ground to push off of. What if there were no ground there for my being to push off of? Couldn't push off. So free choice is possible as long as you have being to push off of. But if you don't have any being to push off of, you can't push off. A self-determined becoming is possible. A self-determined being is impossible. And what is self-determined evil cannot be said to be determined by God. For God cannot cause evil action. Absolute good can perform only good actions. And yet an evil action must be caused by something. Can't be uncaused, for every action involves change. Change is a passing from potency to act. No potency can actualize itself, so every action must be actualized or caused by something. But no evil action can be caused by God. God can concur or cooperate in the sense of permitting the evil action, but he can't cause or produce it. Nor can one's evil action be determined by another, but not by himself, for then he would neither be free nor culpable, which he is. Therefore, all evil actions are caused by the free choice of the individual. Might be well to pause to diagram that. Your actions are either self-caused, caused by another, or uncaused. Let's take an action here and call it an evil action. Let's take an action of, let's say, hate toward another human being. Now, who caused that act of hate? Can't be uncaused because it happened. Every event has a cause. If every event has a cause, then it cannot be an uncaused action. You can't go before the judge and say, I didn't do it. I mean, it was done. If it was done, someone did it. You can't say it was caused by another because if someone else did it, you're not responsible. You say, I didn't do it. If you could really prove that someone else forced you to throw the stone, they put the stone in your hand or put the gun in your hand, then you're not responsible. If it's caused by another, there's no moral responsibility, but there is moral responsibility, therefore it can't be caused by another. So what is that action? It's a self-caused action. All evil actions are self-caused. But self-caused actions are not impossible. Only self-caused beings are impossible. I am the cause of my own action. And if we don't get back to this in our society, we're going to destroy ourselves. Because we blame the Y chromosomes in spec. Remember that guy killed all the nurses in Chicago? They analyzed his Y chromosomes. He had different Y chromosomes. So spec's Y chromosomes caused the killing the nurses. We blame the environment. We blame our parents. We blame our society. We blame everything except a free, morally responsible human being. But if my actions are self-caused actions, then ought implies can. The fact that I ought to do it implies that I can do it. Ought implies can argues against strong determinism. It argues against the view that sin is unavoidable. Sin is avoidable, always is avoidable, by the grace of God. So the argument here is a strong one in favor of a morally responsible universe in which God will ultimately hold people accountable for their actions. That takes us down to the underlying portion of 27, two-thirds of the way down. Therefore, evil actions are caused by free choice of the individual. Hence, it's meaningless to ask, what caused the man to choose evil? His free choice was the cause of evil. And it's senseless to ask, what caused the cause? It's only meaningful to ask, what caused the effect? Once you start asking, what caused the cause, you're asking, when did the bachelor stop beating his wife? Free choice was the first cause of evil action. Say the same thing another way. God created man with free will. Free will makes evil possible. So we have to say that God created the possibility of evil. But creating the possibility of evil is not the same as creating the actuality of evil. We cannot say that God creates the actuality of evil because he can't actually do evil. We must also say that the possibility of evil is a good thing because the possibility of evil is the possibility of a greater good. Without free will, you can't do the greater good. In fact, you can't do any moral good. So with the possibility of evil makes good possible, and it makes the greater good possible. So by making evil possible, God made good possible, and he made the greater good possible. Or to say it another way, God created man at zero. He allowed him to go to minus in order he might bring him up to plus. God created man innocent. He allowed him to become guilty in order that he might make him forgiven. And you say, well, what about those who aren't forgiven? That also manifests an attribute of God. While forgiveness manifests his mercy, hell manifests his justice. So his God is glorified. People are punished in accordance with their sin. And as C.S. Lewis put it in his excellent article in God in the Dock, if you've never read that one about the theory of punishment by C.S. Lewis, it's worth its weight in gold. He said that to punish somebody, no matter how severely, because they knew better, is eminently moral thing to do. But to treat them, not to punish them, but to treat them as though they were sick and need to be cured is immoral, because you're treating them like a patient or a thing. You're not treating them like a morally responsible person. You know, when you get right down to it, almost all of the arguments against hell are built on happiness is the greatest good for people. Hell is a place of ultimate unhappiness. Therefore, if God were really interested in the happiness of all of his creatures, there could be no hell. You know what's wrong with that argument? God's ultimate goal isn't happiness, it's goodness. God's ultimate goal isn't to make everyone feel good, it's to make everyone do good. And if you take the happiness motif, that is a utilitarian approach. It means God wants to bring the greatest amount of happiness to the greatest number of people. Well, hell is certainly incompatible with utilitarianism. But you know what utilitarianism is? It's already a rejection of Christianity. Just read John Stuart Mill and Jeremy Bentham, the people who devised utilitarianism. They had already rejected a penal view of justice, a view of a moral God, and people being morally responsible to him, and an absolute moral law. That's why they worked out this utilitarian calculus: do the greatest good for the greatest number in the long run. God is more concerned about our saintliness than he is our satisfaction. He's more concerned about our virtues than he is about our happiness. And if the ultimate goal in the universe is a moral goal, and not a hedonistic goal, then hell is perfectly compatible with that. Because hell is a place of justice, of permanence, of separation, that vindicates God, that punishes evil, that separates it from the good. But only in a moral universe with an absolute God and an absolute moral law does hell make any sense. You take that theistic framework away from there and start arguing on utilitarian grounds with somebody about hell, and you've lost. You've lost already, because hell is not a place of maximum happiness for the maximum number of people. But who said God was interested in happiness? John Stuart Mill, Jeremy Bentham. God is not ultimately interested in, I'll put it one other way, for effect. If you want to, the best book on the other side of this is John Hick's book, Evil and the God of Love, in which he argues for this, but he points out that there are soul-making theodicies. That means solutions to the problem of evil. A soul-making theodicy is the one he opts for in the Irenaean tradition. Irenaeus had a soul-making theodicy. And I think that that's wrong. A soul-making theodicy is not the kind that God intended. It's a soul-deciding theodicy. A soul deciding in the light of what is good and what is evil, which side they want to be on, good or evil. Now, if the universe is a soul-deciding theodicy, that is, God made free creatures, and the ultimate is for these free creatures. Which generally means make every soul happy, then the final analysis, you can only have one kind of end to that universe. It has to be some kind of universalism. It has to be some kind of universalism where everybody is made happy or the rest are put out of their misery. Annihilation for those who won't be made happy, but second, third, fourth chance, if there's any ray of hope, then keep giving them a chance until everybody finally is made. But you know what a soul-making theodicy it is? It's the same kind of mentality that B.F. Skinner has in Walden 2. It's the same kind of thing. You behaviorally mod people. You keep after them. You nag them. The hound of heaven keeps barking and barking and barking until finally you say, okay, and you throw in the towel. You know, they keep nagging and nagging. It's kind of like I'm talking to the girls now, kind of like a guy that, you know, that you definitely do not want to marry, that just keeps bothering you and hanging around and hanging around. And you tell him to hang it on his nose and he still hangs around and hangs around. And finally you say, oh, wow, okay. You know, by the time you're 63 and there's no one else come around, and you just kind of throw in the towel. Well, is God that kind of person who nags people by love? Is love coercive or just persuasive? Isn't there a point in which, you know, a loving person respects the will of the other? where he respects the freedom and dignity of the person and doesn't force himself. It's two different concepts of man. In this concept, man is a subject to be manipulated, is an object to be manipulated. In this concept, man is a subject who cannot be manipulated. This concept treats man like a patient to be cured. This one treats him like a person to be respected. That's the whole thing in the prisons. You read this article by C.S. Lewis and you see what the liberal concept of prisons. This is the, let's reform him whether he wants to or not, this concept. The whole reformatory concept. This is a penal institution. Let's punish him because he was a person, he knew better. I mean, the best thing you can do to a person is punish them, because that respects their freedom and dignity. It says, you are an intelligent human being and you knew better, so turn over. Punishment is really a respect of man's freedom. So you got a whole different concept. This is why it's so hard to preach hell in the 20th century. So difficult to preach hell, because we've got a whole humanistic society that operates on this soul-making, reformatory, he's a patient, let's manipulate him, let's change him, let's do anything we can because God knows we're the controllers and we need to control type of thing. And if you try to preach hell to these people, they think you're barbaric, insane, irrational, immoral, cruel, vindictive, and all those other nasty terms. So you have to do pre-evangelism. Hell is not one of the first doctrines that I would preach. You have to do pre-evangelism to get them to even understand the context in which hell makes sense. The answer to the physical problem of evil, it's the only one we haven't covered. Theism's answer to the problem of physical evil is that there is no ultimately unjustified physical evil. Now you can see how a free will theodicy explains a lot of evil in the universe. I can understand how free will explains all the rapes, all the murders, all the child abuse in the world, because they're free creatures. But I cannot understand how a tornado and an earthquake are a result of a free act. That's a little more difficult. That's a different problem entirely. Now, if our whole theodicy is a free will theodicy, we have to have some way of explaining tornadoes and earthquakes, etc. The answer to the problem of metaphysical and moral evil does not ipso facto solve the problem of physical evil. 22.11. The solution to metaphysical evil, privation, shows how evil is possible in a perfectly good finite world created by a perfectly good God. The answer to the problem of moral evil, freedom, shows how perfectly good creatures could ever make evil actual, how they could bring evil about, since God could not produce it. But neither of these two explanations accounts for why there appears to be some evil which has been produced apart from free choice, namely unjustifiable evil. For example, many innocent people suffer from war, cruelty, and sickness, as well as from natural catastrophes, floods, tornadoes, and famines. But these evils are sometimes suffered against their free choice and unjustly. Further, God is, according to theism, the cause of natural phenomena. Hence, these evils seem to be caused by God for two reasons. First, because they're not the result of man's free choice. Secondly, because God is the source of natural occurrences, some of which are evil. That is, God's incomplete control of nature. Now, some statements of this problem against theism. First of all, Camus in The Plague. Either one must join the doctor and fight the plague sent by God for man's sin, or else join the priest and not fight the plague. But not to fight the plague is anti-humanitarian, namely the refusal to help to alleviate suffering. And to fight the plague is to fight against God who sent it for man's sin. Hence, if humanitarianism is right, theism is wrong. But humanitarianism is right. It's right to work against suffering. Therefore, theism is wrong. Now let's take Camus' argument. First of all, the theist should not work to eliminate just suffering, culpable punishment. For if one works against just punishment, he is working against justice. And one who works against justice is not just or good.
Hence, the theist should not work against just suffering, since justifiable suffering is good. Just suffering is what a man deservedly brings on himself by his own free evil choice. Hence, a theist should not work against deserved, self-inflicted evils, for he would thereby be working against what is just, and he would be eliminating the good of learning what is right from the evil consequences of evil choices. Good can be learned from bad consequences of evil. Even here, a Christian theist believes in tempering justice with mercy for the repentant. Now, let me give an illustration of that so we get the point. If somebody commits a crime, a Christian should not work to keep him from going to jail. Because if you work to keep him from taking the consequences of his crime, you are working against justice, because justice says he goes to jail for the crime. Or take another illustration. Oftentimes in a home, this will happen, one parent will be a little stronger in discipline than the other. It's usually the father is a little more strong than the mother on a discipline in the home. Not always. If the other intervenes, you know, if one parent says, now you go to your room for the rest of the day, and then leaves and goes somewhere, and the other parent comes in and lets them out, they're working against good. You're working against justice. First of all, you're letting the child know they can divide and conquer, all kinds of bad things, and no consequence for their actions. So we all see those kinds of illustrations. I was called once when Eldridge Cleaver was in prison, and he had allegedly become a Christian. I guess now he's a Mooney, I heard most recently. And I was called and asked if I would help to work for a group to get him released from prison. I said, well, what's the deal? Is he charged with murder? Did he murder? Are you asking me, should I work to release a guilty person, or are we just trying to get a good defense for him? What are we trying to do? Are we trying to do justice that he be properly defended, or are we saying that even if he has committed the crime, we want him released because he's a Christian? It makes a big difference. I'd work for one and not for the other. I would not work to release somebody just because they're a Christian, even if they were guilty. I would work for good defense, for somebody to find out whether they are guilty or not, but not for the other, because we'd be working against justice, and the work against justice is to do the work of injustice. On the other hand, if I had a hole in the backyard that I was, say, building a basement, and I dug a hole, and I told the children, stay away from the hole, and I come out there and one had just fallen in the hole. Now, that's a deliberate disobedience, self-inflicted case. I wouldn't just look at them and say, stay there, dummy. I told you not to go near the hole. I would indeed try and rescue the child. I don't think those two are inconsistent. First of all, they've already paid the consequence. They've already fallen in. It was not a 10-year sentence. I didn't say anyone who falls in will stay there for 10 years. So I'm not really working against justice. They learned their lesson. They disobeyed. They fell in the hole. They had their consequences. And we must temper justice with mercy, too. There is, but you can't have mercy unless there's justice. C.S. Lewis points out that it's impossible to pardon a sick person. See, if criminality is a sickness, and therefore should be treated like a disease, then there is no such thing as pardon. You can't say, oh, pardon you, you got appendicitis? Pardon you. You don't pardon a sickness. You only pardon sin. So even the concept of pardon presupposes justice and mercy. So that's half of the answer to Camus. The other half, 224. However, a theist should work against undeserved and unjustified suffering. Unjustified evil is what a man does not bring on himself by his own choice. Evil is unjustly inflicted on one by others or by nature are apparently unjustified evils. A theist ought to work against these kinds of evils, for example, cruelty, catastrophe. We should put band-aids on. We should be in the rescue squads. In fact, it was we who started the Red Cross in the hospitals. Most hospitals were started by theists and Christians, indeed. Atheists got on a little late. Furthermore, theist works not only against the result of evil, we do put band-aids on, but we're against the cause of evil. In fact, we're the only ones who have the effective answer to the cause of evil. The cause of the plague is evil will. And to work against the cause is more effective than working only against its results. Hence, the theist works against the plague on the most effective level. Of all people in the world, it's theist, Christian theist, who have the answer to the plague. The answer to the plague is repent and accept the cross of Christ, where Christ died for sins and you can get pardoned. We're the ones with that message. And how can Camus say we're not doing anything about the plague? First of all, it was evil will that brought the plague. Adam's sin and ours that brought the evil in the world. Secondly, we're the only ones that have the effective answer to it, the cross of Christ. Thirdly, we're the ones that give more band-aids anyway than the atheist. We're more active in the real mercy, mop-up, rescue mission, Red Cross, help the needy. Well, I have a greater motivation for that than they do. They talk about it a lot, but it's really the Christians. I mean, it's the Mother Teresa's who are doing the dirty work while the liberals are talking about it being done. So we do have an answer, and we are working on it, and Camus' plague dilemma is a false dilemma. The Christian is active in the solution to evil. Okay, let's take another one. The argument against theism by McCloskey. The theist is morally obligated to promote the greatest good. The greatest good cannot be achieved by eliminating suffering, since that's a condition for achieving the greatest good. Hence, the theist is morally obligated not to work to eliminate suffering. Response: the theist is not morally obligated to promote evil means in order to obtain good ends. Promoting suffering as a means to a greater good would be doing this. Hence, the theist is not morally obligated to promote suffering. Furthermore, in working against evil, the theist is not working against the greater goods. For evils are only permitted, not promoted by God as means. God, too, is against promoting evil. He only uses them. Hence, neither God nor man should promote evil in order to produce greater goods. However, an all-knowing God knows men will do evil, and all good God desires to bring greater good out of it, and all-powerful God will produce a greater good by permitting the evil. Therefore, a greater good will be produced by God through permitting evil than if he had not, even without God or man promoting evil means. Therefore, God can achieve a greater good by permitting evil without man promoting it. He knows enough evil is going to happen as a precondition for the good that he doesn't need us to encourage any. In brief, to put it bluntly, I don't need to encourage my children to drive recklessly when they take the car out because they need to learn how to drive safely. Enough reckless driving will occur out there on the Dallas streets by others. We know that will give them plenty of opportunity to develop their character and skills and freedom on the road. I don't need to promote it. Another objection: the theistic God operates on an end justifies the means ethic. This is a good one. For God permits evil means in order to attain the end of a greater good. But this implies that the end of the greater good justifies the permission of the evil means to attain that end. Therefore, the theistic God operates on an end justifies the means ethic. God is utilitarian. Yet theists maintain that God does not allow this kind of ethic for man. Wrong to permit evil in order to obtain a greater good. Hence, there is an equivocal double standard ethic being applied, one for God, where the end justifies the means, and one for man, where it doesn't. So we've argued ourselves in a corner by using the greater good theodicy. Now we're charged with utilitarianism, which is an embarrassing thing for a utilitarian to charge a non-utilitarian with. Response. First, there is a difference between permitting evil and promoting it. We're not saying you should promote evil means to produce good ends. At best, we're saying permit some evil means to promote evil ends. Furthermore, it is not wrong to permit evil if it can be controlled and channeled into a greater good. The end does not justify the means, but it does manifest the God's goodness. It doesn't justify it, but it manifests it. Even human parents do this on a limited scale, permitting their children to err. If you don't permit your children to err, they'll never grow. They'll never mature. You got to permit them the luxury of mistakes, always remembering that you made a few yourself somewhere along the line, and permit them to make mistakes even as you did. Only infinitely good and wise God knows exactly what those amounts of evil are. Back up to 2:6:2:2. An infinitely wise and powerful God can do this on a much larger scale than a parent can, because I can't control all the evil that I permit. For example, I can't permit my child to jump off the cliff, because I can't rescue him on the way down, nor revive him after he hits. God can permit his children to jump off the cliff, because he's going to resurrect them at the end anyway. And then they can jump off all the cliffs they want. Never going to hurt their body again. So there is a kind of double standard here, only because God has more power than I do. So here's the rule of thumb. You only permit the amounts of evil that you can control and reasonably determine that you can bring a greater good out of. That's why you let the umbilical cord out little by little as a child grows up. First, they can't get out of the mother's arms. Secondly, they can't get out of the mother's sight. You know, thirdly, they can't get out of the yard. They can't get out of the neighborhood. You know, you let it out little, more and more all the time. And the more you let it out, the more evil you're permitting. No doubt about it. The more freedom you're giving, the more evil you're permitting. But that's the risk of having free creatures. It's also an absolute necessity for maturity, for growth, and for all that's necessary to become a fully developed human being. Now, God can permit a lot more of that than a parent, because God has a lot more knowledge, a lot more wisdom, and a lot more power to control and bring a greater good out of it. So it's not a double standard. There's a single standard. Each person can permit as much evil, not encourage, but permit as much evil as he can control and bring a greater good out of. I can only do it finitely. God can do it infinitely. Therefore, God is not a utilitarian in that sense of the word. He is not promoting evil to produce good. Or another illustration. What's the difference between euthanasia and inoculation for smallpox? Well, in both cases, people are going to die. In fact, a number of years ago in the United States, the amount of people dying from smallpox vaccination exceeded the amount of people dying from smallpox, which means you stop inoculating, because you're killing more people by the inoculations than you're saving by the inoculations. Now, it's a known fact that whatever mass inoculation occurs, X number of people are going to die. Reaction to the drug. You can't predict. You don't know which ones. You can't predict. So it's not like you're directly killing. So you can't call mass inoculation a form of murder. But it is permitting death in order to produce the greater good. That's not utilitarianism. Because the act of inoculating is not intrinsically evil, nor permitting inoculation is not intrinsically evil. However, euthanasia is an evil, because that's where you're directly taking a life in for some alleged good end. Let's get rid of all these cripples and miserable people in order to make a better society, etc. God does not work on a euthanasia type ethic. He works on an inoculation type ethic. Permit so much evil, which granted so many people will be destroyed by, in order to produce the greater good. It's not any end, any means is justified by the end, but only good means are justified by a good end. So even if God were an end justifies the means, there are two kinds of end justifies the means ethic. Any means, even an evil one, is justified by a good end. That's wrong. A good means will justify this good end. That's right. Seems to me that's what inoculation is. A good means, inoculation, will justify a good end. Even if the good means, freedom, will allow some evil. Even if the good means, inoculation, will allow some death. So there are two kinds of end justifies the means. And when we say the end doesn't justify the means, we don't really mean that. What we mean is an evil means is not justified by a good end, or a good end does not justify an evil means. But we do not mean to say that a good means is not justified by a good end. Most certainly is. Hence, while the standard is the same, the amount of evil God can permit is greater than man, because his power and wisdom are greater to control it and to produce a greater good. So we have a single standard. The single standard is it is right to permit, though not promote, that amount of evil which can reasonably assured to be controlled and bring a greater good. Inoculations fits that. But it is not right to promote it, intentionally kill others, and it's not right to permit the kind of evil that you can't control. Like, you don't watch a murder, permit it, because you can't reverse it. God hasn't committed that ability into your hands. Another objection to theism via physical evil or suffering: there are some unjustified evils in the world which do not result from our free choice, and or which do not bring a greater good. For example, cruelty doesn't bring a greater good, certainly not for the victim or for the criminal. Catastrophes like tornadoes don't. But any unjustified evil eliminates the theistic God. It shows whatever God there may be is less than absolutely just and or powerful. Therefore, the unjustified evil that does exist eliminates theism. In the light of this objection, it seems to me that we have to show that 100% of all physical evil is somehow connected to free will, because free will is the justification for allowing moral evil. Moral evil is any evil that affects moral beings. So how can we show that all tornadoes are connected to free will, or earthquakes? Is the devil causing the tornado or the earthquake? Is some extraterrestrial being doing it? You know, how can we do it? Well, all physical suffering can be accounted for on a theistic basis as justified. As in light of the justification we've given above, that God exists and he has moral purposes, including free will, for his beings, we can account for 100% of all physical evil. Let's try. One, some physical evil results directly from our own free choice. Some sickness. I would say 90% of sickness probably is directly related to our own free choices. I know it is in my case. I know it is in people I know well. All-nighters will definitely produce colds, and if you do enough of them, mono and all of the other sicknesses. Most campus diseases are caused by not getting enough sleep, exercise, proper diet. Just those alone, if you get enough sleep and exercise and proper diet, will eliminate most of the sicknesses that we get. Most of them are caused by tension, and that we bring on ourselves. We make our bed, we lie in it. I'm about at least 90% Christian Science, I think. They're right. About 90% of it is psychosomatic. And a number of years ago, I became convinced of that in my own case. I had a very bad allergy, and I would sneeze even at flowers in the church foyer. I was sneezing once at flowers in a church foyer. And before I was going to preach, I asked the man if he'd move them. He said, "Those are plastic." So I said to myself, "Self, if you're sneezing at plastic flowers, it at least has to partly be up there, whatever else it is involved." And I was taking very strong pills at that time, ornate pills, and I just gradually took less and less until I took none. Now, I still sneeze at certain things, but I don't have allergy like I used to have. I also am allergic to dogs, dog hair. I know why I'm allergic to dog hair. It's a spiritual problem. I'll tell you what the spiritual problem is. When I was 2 years old, a very friendly dog of our family, my sister was petting it, and I went over to pet it, and it jumped up and bit me in the eye. Just missed my eyeball. I've never forgiven that dog. It's a spiritual problem, lack of forgiveness. In fact, I hate dogs. I hate them. I just soon run over a dog. And I'm allergic to dog hair. No great mystery that I'm allergic to dog hair. I'm going to have to learn to love dogs before I can conquer that allergy. I'm going to have to learn to pet them and forgive. I got to forgive the first one. I got to forgive all other dogs. They didn't do it, you know, and learn to be friends. I think most of our problems we cause ourselves. Secondly, some evil results indirectly from our own free choices. Poverty from laziness. We don't always directly bring all evil on ourselves. If you're lazy, that's a free choice. Poverty will come. A little folding of the hands, a little closing of the eyes, as Solomon said. Poverty comes upon you. That's indirect, but it's just as connected to free will as is a psychosomatic sickness connected to free will. Or an all-nighter is connected to your cold that you have. Three, some evil results from free choice of others directly. Other people have free choice too. Child abuse. Well, the child didn't choose to be abused, but the free choice of the parent was involved there. The parent did freely choose to abuse the child. And in a universe where people are free, then the freedom of some people is going to impinge on others. So that particular evil can be accounted for by freedom. All we're trying to show is how all evil in the universe can be accounted by free will. That's all we're trying to show. We're not trying to say my direct free will. It's my direct and indirect free will. Psychosomatic, laziness, child abuse, indirect. Fourthly, some evil results indirectly from free choice of others. See, poverty works both ways. Poverty can be a child's problem or a parent's problem. If it's a child's problem, he didn't choose it. Parent may have chosen it. I saw a lot of that when I was younger because I was born in the worst year of the Depression, 1932. And the worst year of the Depression, so we had a lot of poverty. I mean, I remember it getting so bad, we ate our pet rabbit. That's right. Every night, to this day, I don't like bologna, because that's all we had to eat every night. We had these slices of bologna. We have a slice of bologna and then a little boiled potato. And that every night except Sunday, we'd have rabbit or chicken that we had grown. Well, it got so bad that we had eaten up all the rabbits, and we got down to Nancy. White rabbit with pink eyes. And we got so hungry that we had to kill Nancy. Now, we couldn't kill it. The neighbor had to kill it because nobody could kill Nancy. We'd kill rabbits all the time, but it's kind of hard to kill your fat rabbit. I don't remember who finally cooked it, but I do remember the day. I was only maybe about six, seven years old. We all sat there at the table and looked at Nancy. Nobody could eat Nancy. We were hungry. I mean, you can eat rabbit, but you can't eat Nancy. White, a pink eye, white rabbit. Well, things were bad in those days. They were not good. I remember poverty. I also remember poverty. Some poverty was in our family, and others was due to a free choice. My father was an alcoholic, and I remember him gambling and drinking and all the family fighting. That wasn't my choice. I didn't have any choice in it, you know. I didn't have any choice in the fact that the hand-me-downs that were given to me weren't hand-me-downs from older brothers. I didn't have any. I got hand-me-downs from older sisters. My mother just had to reverse the buttons, you know, and holes on the other side of them. I don't like clothes with holes, you know, but they buy them with holes today, you know. That's a sign to me of utter poverty and of fact, I didn't have any choice in that. But it was due to free will. It was due to free choice, some of it.